The question of terror and terrorism appears to be abused and misused. For example, in my country of origin, it is alleged that 3 or 4 terrorists are hiding. And a neighboring country has invaded with the support and instigation of the United States, my adopted country. As a result, thousands have been killed, millions have been displaced, and what has happened was that when the international community rushed with aid to find, to give food, shelter, and other assistance to these people, they were prevented from being supplied by their own people and by the occupation and invading country. And when they were asked why they are treating their people in that manner, they were told they are terrorists. These people are terrorists. Near our home, I am aware of a man who has come here as a refugee, a Somali, and he has a family. The head of the household told his sons and daughters that they have to support somebody who is in need of support because he has no one and who is a very close relative. One of the sons told his father, if you ever ask me again for assistance to be sent to that part of the world, Somalia, I will go to the authorities and tell them that my father, you, is sponsoring or financing terrorists.
You have a question, sir. You need to ask a question here.
Where we draw the line between a terrorist and what you call a genuine terrorist who should be fought against and eliminated if possible, and the accusation of this widely used as a terrorist and being accepted by many authorities. Thank you very much.
Do you want to take that to domestic?
Well, actually, I think that I'll just stay right here if you can see me. The point that I'd like to focus on, what the gentleman said, is that when the United States is so powerful that when it produces a doctrine like the war on terror, it doesn't just incentivize masses of U.S. government agencies and U.S. corporations, U.S. universities, and U.S. lobbyists. It incentivizes regional powers and predators all over the world who then immediately see that doctrine and the ability to call anybody they don't like a terrorist as an opportunity. So soon after the declaration of the war on terror and after we went into Iraq, I predicted that the Israelis would invade Lebanon and go into Nablus as Jenin, as they did. I actually thought it took a longer time to go into Lebanon than I thought because I didn't realize the role that Sharon was playing to restrain it. But he did use that rhetoric immediately to say what the Americans did in Afghanistan, we get to do in Jenin and we get to do in Beirut. And the same argument will be made by Ethiopia in Somalia. And the same argument will be used by Turkey at some point. In other words, we have to see the dynamic of what happens when we create something we no longer control. It has a ramifying effect across the globe, not just inside our country.
Okay. This lady right here.
Thank you. First, I want to thank you for the thought that I hadn't really put together. And what I heard you say was like 9/11 has become a cash cow for agencies. So, I mean, I'd never really put that into perspective that way. But the question that I have, what is our aversion to diplomacy? Apparently, Jimmy Carter is trying to have talks with Hamas. What is our aversion to diplomacy?
Do you want to take that one, Derek?
Yes, excuse me. That's an excellent question. And I think that there's a way of understanding that sort of goes beyond the the surface debate that's gone on around, you know, between Obama and Hillary Clinton, for example, about, you know, whether you should negotiate without preconditions with Iran or whatever. And that is that, again, using an institutional framework for understanding this problem, in other words, how institutions operate to protect and enlarge their institutional interests. You look at the national security state of the United States, the National Security Council, the Pentagon, and the State Department, and you ask, you know, who has the initiative, who has the clout politically in terms of making national security policy writ large, and particularly in the Middle East, in places where the United States has troops. The answer is those people who have an institutional interest in essentially maintaining their existing programs. How do you do that? You take a hard line. You do not have ideas about negotiating away your presence in Iraq, for example. Just, you know, as a random example, let's say. You know, I think this is a good illustration of the dynamics at work within the national security state on this absolutely crucial question. The politics within not just the Bush administration, I think you go back to the Clinton administration, and you see that looking at how negotiating proposals for Iran during the early period of the Clinton administration fared, you find that the politics were against it within the national security state in the Clinton era. And I don't know all the inside story, but I think we know enough to suggest that you know, there were powerful bureaucratic interests, partly military, but in that case, also those interests which were particularly interested in an agreement with Israel to protect Israeli interests, which then became a major reason for not negotiating with Iran. Another reason on top of the military one.
Okay. Over here.
Thank you. Jim Jatras from the American Council for Kosovo. Let me say that I agree wholeheartedly with the central thesis today, the mistaken place of Iraq in this so-called strategy. I am puzzled, though, where the panelists seem to agree with one key thesis of the Bush administration's war on terrorism, and that is the notion that the evildoers are just an aberrant group of hijackers of a religion of peace and tolerance, and this is simply a reactive or opportunistic phenomenon. You know, let us remember that the United States has strongly supported Islamic radical movements at least since the Afghan war, that through our proxies, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, we helped put the Taliban in place. The neocons strongly supported the Clinton administration's support for Islamic forces in the Balkans. That, you know, we've helped put a Sharia-based state in place of a secular thug in Iraq, that, you know, the neocons are as hostile to Russia and China, for example, as they are to the so-called terrorists, and still see Islamic radicals as a benign force against those states, that, as Mr. Porter pointed out, regime change, which is really the agenda here, will actually benefit radical Islamic forces in places like Syria, where the Muslim Brotherhood would come to power, and Central Asia, where Hizbut Tahrir would be. So my question is, in the context of essentially a sound thesis, why should we essentially whitewash a jihad ideology that has very broad, deep roots, and actually doctrinally is quite sound if you read their literature, and in no way is comparable to a truly fringe group like, say, the Aryan Nations?
Who wants to do that?
Well, I'd like to respond to that. I'm familiar with this, with the argument, and fact is that the United States throws itself around so unthinkingly because it feels itself to be so big. That's why it doesn't negotiate. You don't negotiate if you feel that you actually can just tell people what to do. You only negotiate when you think you can't tell somebody what to do or you can't just force them. So we just throw our weight around pretty. So it's hard to know whether we've benefited Muslim fundamentalism more by supporting jihadis in Afghanistan directly or by supporting the Shah in trying to repress Muslims in Iran, only to give a volcanic opening to them? Or the same thing with Israel. Do we help Hamas more by fueling Israeli maximalism in the West Bank and protecting settlements, or by supporting Hamas directly? Well, that's pretty obvious. So it's just a generally out-of-control foreign policy that doesn't really feel that it has to be domesticated, but rather can be allowed to be driven by short-term slogans and domestic political party interests. So that is a root problem as I see it. When it comes to jihadism and the coherence of the ideology, there's nothing so coherent as Christian apocalyptic fundamentalism, which is a much more dangerous thing in the long run, in my view, because, for one thing, Muslims, even if you take the ideological position, they are ready to accept, okay, the caliphate's going to be here, and then there'll be the other countries. But from a Christian fundamentalist point of view, there's nowhere that can be anything but Christian in the end. And they're ready to blow up, to generate Armageddon over the Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif just in order to get their program forwarded. So, wait a minute. Exactly how important are these ideas? And how important is the Aryan Nation compared to al-Qaeda? Well, there's a lot of racist ideas. There's a lot of fascist ideas that are out there. And there were jihadi, ideas before 9/11 also. But you can't see in the polling data anything like the support for Osama bin Laden that exists after 9/11 and after our war in Iraq, that existed specifically after the war in Iraq, that existed before. The polling numbers for the Aryan Nation in the United States are almost exactly the same as they were for al-Qaeda before 9/11, before the war in Iraq, specifically.
Very quickly, I would just say I absolutely agree with the first point that you made, that the Bush administration's policy has, in fact, done a great deal to promote, not just Bush, but also previous policy has done a great deal to promote, unwittingly, I presume, not because it was the objective, but because it fit the political and bureaucratic interests of various parties, individuals, and institutions in the national security state. But I do have a bit of a neuralgia about any tendency, and you can say that it's not your tendency, but I thought I'd pick this up, to conflate different types of Islamism and to attach a label, which is perhaps jihadism or whatever. I mean, obviously, and I'm sure you understand this, the difference between the Hezbollah in Lebanon and anything that has to do with al-Qaeda or its associated organizations is huge. And so I would certainly not want to have any confusion about that, nor about the fundamental distinction between the al-Qaeda ideology on one hand and an attitude among Arabs, particularly Sunni Arabs, of course, in the Middle East, which accepts the notion of jihadism in the face of occupation of Muslim lands by U.S. troops, which does not make them into a Wahhabi or a al-Qaeda-like figure simply by saying we support jihadism. Jihad, after all, is defensive warfare against. Okay, well, we can argue about that after the session. I'll be glad to talk to you about that. Yeah.
Okay, right here. There's this gentleman in the front.
I generally follow the credo in discussing and explaining Washington that one shouldn't usually attribute malice or conspiracies or planning to things that could be easily and logically explained by stupidity, incompetence, ignorance, and hubris. And both of you, in fact, all three of you have alluded to, sometimes directly and or sometimes indirectly, to the stupidity, incompetence, ignorance, et cetera, of this administration in particular and also the Clinton administration, but you've also used the term cabal. And that term has been used quite frequently, especially if you follow the media in the Middle East and the various websites. And it, as soon as you use that, people go off on wild tangents. And plus the fact that the neocons, if they had a cabal, well, they may have gotten us in there, but afterwards they really screwed things up royally. Could you sort of reconcile the sort of divergent side of cabal versus stupidity and idiocy?
Well, I think if you do a mimetic search, you'll find that one of the first uses of that word was when I used it at the Middle East Policy Forum back in 2002, before the war was launched. And I analyzed that that's what was going to bring the war. And what people don't often know, and there's been a lot of controversy about the use of the term, but in fact, some of the members actually proudly describe themselves that way. And I quote that discussion in my book. But I tried to outline the answer to your question in my talk. That there, on the one end, yes, this group, the Project for the New American Century, basically that group that took control of the national security apparatus after 9/11, having failed to be able to take control of it in the first 9 months of the Bush administration, got what it wanted and did so by creating a war on terror, which within a short time it no longer was able to control. So it's a double movement. First, they created a war on terror in order to get the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq went south, but we're stuck with the war on terror politically. And so are they. In fact, Rumsfeld and Cheney both tried to get rid of the name war on terror. And the long war, the war against Islamofascism, nothing worked. Because I don't think the president had trouble saying anything except the war on terror. He even had trouble saying the war on terrorism. So they stuck with the war on terror. But I'm very clear that, from my point of view, this group was acting as the first and most successful faction and a model for every lobbying group, from universities to large corporations to pediatricians, who went to the government and said, we need new funds to teach pediatricians how to care for children when they're under a terrorist attack. Because caring for the victims of terrorist attacks who are adults is not the same as caring for children. So every one of these factions in the country did what the cabal did originally. It's a natural response. I wouldn't say it's incompetence, stupidity. It's cupidity institutionalized. We call it Madisonian democracy. And it's been hijacked by Al-Qaeda. Okay. And they didn't even realize they were going to be that successful.
Okay, I think we only got time for one last question, right over here.
Can I ask you how to get your points across to the American people? And let me add the earmarks now, the 15,000 earmarks in defense. The Wall Street Journal yesterday had an article. A company gave $24,000 of donations to the campaign, which is, they'd be called bribes anywhere else in the world. For the chairman of one of the committees, and then they got several millions of dollars sent to their company in Texas. There's a story anyway, it's there. But the whole point of earmarks, there are 15,000 earmarks, a tremendous group now that want unending wars, et cetera, and profit from them. And getting this, your points of view across to the American public, how can one do it? I would suggest the only way is corruption and follow the money. People have to understand how corrupt the whole process has become in America. But how do you all suggest, other than a meeting like this, how do you get these ideas into the political dialogue?
Well, the Independent Institute is helping, but it is a real problem. My book, I was invited to 40 or 50 places to speak. And there's a website, Trapped in the War on Terror, that you can go to, .com, that you can go to. And I mentioned that I have done consulting work, and I feel like I'd be doing the same thing everybody else is unless my audience hears this message and tries to start asking politicians to speak truthfully about it, not tolerate the slogans. The audience, the readers, really have to act. Now, how to do it? I could hardly get this book reviewed anywhere. I talked to a leading columnist, a leading journalist, and the bottom line is, from the press's point of view, this is Hurricane Osama. This is the blizzard of the century. It's always about to hit. Hovering out there is nothing. It doesn't get better than that for the press. Whenever they need a story, they've got it. And you see a blizzard, the weathermen, you know, they go crazy. They love it when a blizzard is approaching, but the blizzard eventually passes or fizzles, and the story goes away. But Hurricane Osama never goes away. It's always out there about to hit. So there's a institutionalized block against getting this kind of argument a lot of play.
Yara? We need a wealthy donor to give some money to have a political organization and movement in this country that delegitimizes the existing system for national security policy, specifically on the point of the way in which the military bureaucracy maintains and expands its power through its control over the process of policymaking, and of course, grabs an inordinate share of the national resources in doing so. Diane Perlman, who's in the front row here, has, I think, the classic slogan for such a movement, which is, "Don't be a sucker." Take a bow, Diane. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's all that we really have time for. We're slightly over already. So I'd just like to welcome everybody to take some food over here, and thank